Welcome back to hour number two, Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking about the recent political unrest in Tibet. The government of China says that Tibet is and has officially been part of China for hundreds of years. However, many Tibetans argue just as strongly that there is a long history of Tibetan independence. And Tibetan activists around the world, certainly many of them in the United States, have continued to argue for, if not independence, that is greater autonomy for Tibet. In March, anger over Chinese rule of Tibet prompted some of the biggest protests seen there in decades, not only in Tibet, in the capital Lhasa, but in other places in China, other provinces of China that have significant Tibetan populations. The Chinese government responded to these demonstrations with force. Many people were arrested, hundreds, perhaps more than 1,000 were arrested, and pro-independence groups outside Tibet have also said that many people were killed. In this part of the program, we'll try to talk a little bit about this conflict and see if we can get a better understanding here of what is at stake. And we have, as our guest, Elliot Sperling. He is professor at Indiana University at Bloomington, where his specialty is Tibet, Tibetan history, relations between Tibet and China, and also India. As we talk this morning with Professor Sperling, questions certainly are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who are calling in is that people are brief in their comments and questions so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and get in as many as we can. The number, though, here in Champaign-Urbana, certainly we're open to questions. The number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, certainly questions are welcome. Again, here where we are in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Sperling, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
What I'd like to do is maybe for a moment just go back and try to talk about what happened back in mid-March. It seemed that it, certainly at least in the beginning, there was confusion about what was going on because the Chinese wouldn't let reporters go and observe, Western reporters. And mostly what we were getting was accounts of what happened either from the Chinese government or from the Tibetan exile community. And both of them obviously have an interest in promoting a particular kind of story, telling a particular kind of story about what was going on there. Just basically, what do we know about what happened?
Well, essentially, on March 10th, which is a very potent date, I might add, maybe we can talk about that later, but that's the date of the 1959 uprising, or the date that is used to symbolize that uprising, which lasted for several days in 1959, and which for Tibetans in exile is their national day, but clearly it also has tremendous significance for Tibetans inside Tibet, because it was on March 10th that monks from a monastery on the outskirts of Lhasa, the Tibetan capital, undertook a protest march into town, and that was suppressed by the authorities. There were subsequent marches then in the days after, and then finally on March 14th, a major demonstration which quickly became violent. And this is the demonstration that the Chinese government really points to. They don't talk about the earlier demonstrations. They have, as the Chinese government often does, they've given the whole thing a name. It is the incident of smashing, burning, and looting. And for them, that's all that it was. It did at some point degenerate into that, but that is in the face of armed repression from China, which started at one point. And originally, the Chinese touch was very, very light. And then, as things became violent at first, they pulled back. But they then went in force, ultimately. In terms of what we... And the other thing which we need to be aware of, that it's not simply in Lhasa that this has been happening. There are maybe 100 or so incidents that we know of in Lhasa and all over the Tibetan Plateau, which is to say not just the Tibet Autonomous Region, which is the area that China considers Tibet, but those Tibetan autonomous units in neighboring provinces, which altogether form a contiguous whole of Tibetan habitation. And all over there you've had demonstrations in sympathy and in protest also about the conditions and about Tibetan aspirations.
No, perhaps I shouldn't interrupt. I was going to launch into another question, but please continue.
Well, I just wanted to say, in terms of what we know, it's very interesting. It's much easier, though not completely easy, especially now, to know what is going on in Tibet than it was 20 years ago. International telecommunications reaches all over. In the opening days, there were people who were able to call relatives in Tibet to find out, Tibetans who live outside Tibet, and also Westerners with Tibetan contacts were able to call relatives and ask questions about what was going on. Now, this became very difficult after a while, and we also have email and other avenues. But there have been some reasonably, what we generally consider to be reasonably accurate reports which have come out from Tibet, not just from the exiles, but from Tibet itself, which get a significant distribution now. So it's a different situation than what we had previously.
And do we have, do you think, reliable figures about the numbers of people that either have been arrested or have been killed?
No.
Okay.
No, we don't. There's a big gap between what the Chinese government says, which is, you know, literally a handful of people killed, except they give emphasis to Chinese who died in what they call smashing, burning, and looting. And I don't want to play that down. Clearly, there were Chinese deaths, and this has been regretted certainly by the Dalai Lama and by most Tibetan supporters outside Tibet. I would say all Tibetan supporters outside Tibet. But you have to understand that this comes after decades of repression of basic rights to freedom of expression. In the earlier demonstrations, you had monks that were taken away, and as everybody knows, and we know this from experience, you can go to reports from Amnesty International and from Human Rights Watch, imprisonment in Tibet is generally accompanied by torture when it's a political issue. And given the place of the monks within Tibetan society, this is a very, very volatile thing. So the arrest of the monks, and this is after several days of demonstrations, finally order broke down on March 14th.
So you think that the reason that this went from this, what was initially a peaceful protest by Buddhist monks, to mark this the 10th of March, this important date from this 1959 uprising, that then the reason that then this kind of exploded and drew in citizens, what that had to do with, at least a lot of that had to do with their feelings about the way that the monks had been treated after they staged
in
these
part,
initial
kind. In part, the people who were demonstrating had their own grievances, and the fact that they targeted Chinese shops. And the shops are owned by Chinese Muslims, and this is where you had the deaths, because they set fire to several shops. This has to do with their own sense of being exploited. You have to understand, for most of them, they can remember a time when there were very few Chinese in Tibet, or certainly far fewer than you had now. If you go back to the time when Tibet was incorporated into the People's Republic of China, 1951, there were practically no Chinese in Lhasa. Now, in Lhasa, the Chinese are the overwhelming majority of the population. This is something one has to remember, that the overwhelming majority of the population, many Tibetans feel marginalized. And so things did get out of hand, one can say, in that sense. But there were very, very deep grievances. It's not just one thing. There are a number of grievances which you have there.
Well, let's just, I want to have you maybe just talk a little bit more about that point that you touched on, because one of the things that I want to try to do is to unpack this a little bit and talk about, when you know, if you ask this question, what do Tibetans want? I think that you have to say, well, what Tibetans are you talking about? Are you talking about the exile community that lives outside of Tibet? Are you talking about people who live in Tibet? And then if you're talking about people who live in Tibet, are you talking about people who live in the city? Are you talking about people who live in Lhasa? Are you talking about people who live in the countryside? But at least as far as people are concerned who live in Tibet, this seems to be one of the chief complaints, or at least what I see in many of the articles that I read, and that is that there has been this deliberate policy by China to move ethnic Chinese, Han Chinese, into Tibet to, in a sense, dilute the power of the indigenous people, the Tibetan people, and the Tibetan people are complaining that as these Chinese have moved in, there may indeed have been economic development in Tibet, but it's the Chinese are the ones that primarily have benefited. Is that all true?
I would say, to a certain extent, it is true. The fact of the matter is that I would say the Chinese government has certainly encouraged the migration. They don't need to implement a program to force people to move to Tibet. This used to be what they wanted to do in the, you know, during the more socialist phase of the People's Republic of China. But the fact of the matter is that there is money to be made in Tibet. And this is what brings a lot of these migrant Chinese migrants into Tibet, basically to make money there. But the fact is that this has led to a sense of being exploited on the part of the Tibetans. Excuse me, I'm a bit under the weather today. This has led to a sense of being exploited on the part of the Tibetans, and has also engendered a lot of resentment. When you say, what do they want, though? I mean, all of these factors, you know, the political repression, the denial of human rights, the sense that they are being exploited by Chinese who move to Tibet, make a lot of money, and take advantage of opportunities that are not available to Tibetans because of the language differences and the educational differences, all of this feeds into it. But the interesting thing is that, you know, when the slogan that you hear most often in Tibet is "Pur Rang Zin Sang Mei Yin," which is, you know, Tibet is independent. Now, there are people who like to interpret this in a certain way and say, well, they don't really mean that they want to be independent, that they really just want some freedom. But that's not what they're saying. So it makes it a bit difficult to explain, and that's because the Dalai Lama himself says he doesn't want independence. He's made it very clear he does not want Tibet to be independent. Mm-hmm. So there is a bit of a contradiction there.
Well, also, I wonder, as you say, that, you know, the Chinese government has said, well, these people, these Tibetans, they want independence, and that's something that China cannot accept, and that many Tibetans and the Dalai Lama have said, no, that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is greater autonomy, perhaps, for Tibet within China. Now, I expect also there may indeed be within the Tibetan diaspora, there may indeed be people who would say, no, what we are talking about is independence. I mean, is there any within the Tibetan exile community, is there some significant group of people who would say, no, we're not talking about autonomy. We really are talking about independence, or at least that's what we would want if we had our way.
I think if you ask most Tibetans in exile what they would want, they would say independence. And then there are some who are willing to accept the autonomy position simply because it comes from the Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. And in other words, they won't, you know, they don't want to discuss the logic of it or anything, but simply because it comes from the Dalai Lama, they're willing to accept it. Now, my view of this is, and I've written about this, you know, it's somewhat critical of the Dalai Lama in the sense that I see him as being rather politically naive about China. The Dalai Lama decided in the early 1970s that he did not want to, that his position was not one of independence for Tibet. He did not want Tibetan independence. He only made that public in the 1980s, the late 80s. And that was in France in a statement that is known as the Strasbourg Proposal, which he made there, and he said that he wanted Tibet to be a democratic entity within the People's Republic of China. Now, he has repeated this again and again, and the Chinese response has consistently been, even during these disturbances that we've had in Tibet now, that the Dalai Lama is not sincere, that the Dalai Lama must sincerely give up independence, the Dalai Lama must sincerely state that he gives up independence. And they also sometimes add the corollary that he also must accept that Taiwan is a part of China. Now, the Dalai Lama has nothing politically to do with Taiwan. But the Dalai Lama's response to all that has been, the Chinese government doesn't understand me. I don't want independence. And he's made a point wherever he goes, when he's met U.S. presidents, British prime ministers, and other heads of state, he's made it clear he does not want independence for Tibet, and that the Chinese government doesn't understand him. And he's done this again and again and again. And every time he says publicly, I do not want independence, the Chinese response is, he has to say it clearly, and he has to say it sincerely. He is not sincere. He wants disguised independence, or there's something like that. The fact is that in spite of the Dalai Lama saying that China doesn't understand him, China understands him very well. They have thousands of people working in the government on the Tibet issue, whether they're in the foreign ministry or they're dealing with nationality affairs, they parse every single word the Dalai Lama says. And so, as I've often said, as far as the Dalai Lama is concerned, China knows what the meaning of the word is. And so they know what his stand is. They know he does not want independence. The fact is, China does not want the Dalai Lama back, period. He's in his 70s now. China's attitude has been that they will wait for him to die. Now, when he dies, that will solve the Tibet issue. Now, I don't think that's going to solve the Tibet issue. A number of people don't think it's going to solve the Tibet issue, but the fact is the Chinese government assumes that it will, because once he dies, they will choose their own Dalai Lama, and they believe that that will be that, that there will be no real core or real center for the issue. And so in a sense, the Dalai Lama has been manipulated. The Chinese government knows that if a Chinese spokesperson comes and says Tibet should not be independent, most people will say, well, that's Chinese propaganda. But if the Dalai Lama says it again and again, then people listen. So they basically turned the Dalai Lama into the primary spokesperson against Tibetan independence.
You know, it seems hard to believe that the Chinese would think that if the Dalai Lama died and they named their own Dalai Lama, it seems hard to believe that the Chinese would think that the rest of the world, that Tibetans certainly, and a lot of the rest of the world would accept that person.
I think they know that that's a very hard sell, but they think, or at least they've thought up until, I don't know if their thinking has changed in the last month, but up until the last month, certainly they thought that whatever problems arise, there were problems that could be handled. the fact is that they've already been preparing for this moment. They allowed the reincarnation of the Karmapa, who's another lama, to be recognized within Tibet, very high incarnate lama. This is in the 1990s. They allowed it. The funny thing, though, is that in 2000, he fled to India. And he was supposed to be groomed, you know, as a very high-ranking patriotic, as they say, patriotic lama. Mm-hmm. Then when the lama that some people consider to be the second highest incarnation within the hierarchy, the Panchen Lama, he died in the late 1980s. His incarnation was recognized by the Dalai Lama in exile in 1995. This enraged China. They took the child whom the Dalai Lama had recognized, who was in Tibet. The Dalai Lama made his recognition from exile, but the child was in Tibet. And the Dalai Lama did this in coordination with the Panchen Lama's own monastery in Tibet. So as a result, people in the monastery were arrested. The child that was recognized was placed incommunicado, and nobody has had access to him. Human rights organizations have asked for this. Even Western governments have asked for access to the Panchen Lama. This has consistently been denied. China then appointed its own Panchen Lama. Now, that Panchen Lama is largely not accepted by the Tibetans. And, in fact, he resides in Beijing mostly. You know, they keep him out of Tibet. It would be somewhat embarrassing. And I can tell you, you know, at times when I've been in Tibet, you know, you almost never see his picture in places where you would normally see it. When Tibetans put up a picture of the Panchen Lama, they'll put up the previous one or the one before that, but almost nobody puts up a picture of the Chinese government-recognized Panchen Lama. And, instances when I've asked about that, you know, and I've asked, who this Chinese government Panchen Lama is, you know, I've asked Tibetans, is he the real Panchen Lama? And, you know, this is not a scientific survey. It's very difficult to do that in Tibet. But I've gotten one of two answers from Tibetans in Tibet. One is, no, he's the Chinese Panchen Lama. I mean, he's not the real Panchen Lama. The other answer is, I'm not allowed to say. So what they're thinking is that, nevertheless, they could still manage this. And interestingly enough, last year, they imposed regulations, new regulations, on the recognition of incarnations, which impose government control, basically, over the entire process. And this one didn't have before. So this is all in preparation for China ultimately choosing its own Dalai Lama.
I should take a moment here to introduce again our guest, and then we have a caller to bring into the conversation. We're talking this morning with Elliot Sperling. He is Associate Professor of Central Eurasian Studies at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, where he teaches courses on Tibetan history and Tibetan-Chinese relations and Tibetan language. And he's also interested in all those things, as well as India and Indian studies. And we're talking about the recent political unrest in Tibet. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here to talk with in Champaign, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi, how's it going today?
Yeah, it's good, thanks.
I've got a few questions, and my phone is dying, so I'm going to make them quick and then listen on the radio.
Okay.
The first is, do you think that there is any good being done with the protests in San Francisco, in London, in Paris? The second is, do you think the Dalai Lama is settling for autonomy, though would, if had the option, would choose independence? And then the third is, if do you think that once the Dalai Lama passes away, do you think the new Lama chosen by the Chinese people will be accepted? So I'm going to listen. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, the I think that we
covered the third one
pretty well here just in the last couple of minutes.
The answer to that is basically no, and then the question is whether or not China can manage the discontent that that would entail.
All right. And at this point, the Dalai Lama is 72. We wish him good health and long life. So who knows when, in fact, that might become an issue. The first question, though, has to do with the protests that have taken place in conjunction with the running of the Olympic torch. We saw it in Paris. We saw it just recently in San Francisco. Next, it's moving on to South America. I'm not sure where else it's going to go, but certainly it has been used by people as a way to protest generally the human rights record of China, and very specifically China's conduct in Tibet, and particularly in places like San Francisco, where there is a significant Tibetan community. There has been a lot of protest, and in fact, also Chinese people have turned out to as counter-protest. So the question I think the caller raises is a good one. Do you think that these kind of protests achieve anything?
I think they certainly do. They bring attention to the issue, and I can't underestimate how important that is for an issue like Tibet. I've been involved in Tibetan studies now for, I can say, decades. And the fact of the matter is that for a long time, the issue got very little coverage, even though conditions in Tibet were in many ways as bad, if not worse, than they are now. Excuse me. So I certainly would say that the protests serve a purpose. And they, you know, the protests in the United States and the protests in London and in Paris have basically gone on without without real violence, I would say. I mean, there's been some scuffling, but no real violence.
Mm-hmm.
They've also called, you know, I've been following this. There's also been an issue that's come up with the protests that the Olympic flame is being carried by, rather is being guarded by members of the People's Armed Police in blue and white tracksuits. This is the same paramilitary unit. Well, this is not exactly that unit, but it is the People's Armed Police that has been most active in repression in Tibet. And so some attention has been called to that as well. But it basically calls attention to the issue, so it does serve an educational function.
Okay. And then the other question, and we've touched on this a little bit, but again, we'll have you address it. The Dalai Lama, for some time now, has officially been saying, no, I'm not calling for Tibetan independence. That's not what I'm supporting. What I'm talking about is autonomy. But the caller raises this question, well, is he settling for that because he knows that's more achievable? And if he, in his heart of hearts, if he had what he wanted, would he in fact say, well, what I really would want, yes, if you ask me that question, what I really would want would be an independent Tibet?
No, I think he's very sincere. I think he really does not want Tibetan independence. He said so on many occasions, and I don't think he's being deceptive or disingenuous. I think he really doesn't think independence is that important. I have to say, I don't think he really understands what the sense of nationalism is that his people have. A number of people don't. In the 90s, in the early part of this decade, a lot of the reports you would read from Tibet would talk about economic development. Now, we've already mentioned the fact that a lot of that has to do with Chinese movement into Tibet. But reports would say that, nevertheless, there was a trickle-down effect, and that was quite true, a trickle-down effect in Tibet, and that ultimately this is going to dissipate Tibetan nationalism. Tibetans might not like it, but basically they'll have economic rewards in exchange for giving up Tibetan nationalism. Well, that misread the situation, as we've seen over the last months. I mean, that nationalism hasn't always been dead. With a Tibetan friend of mine, we've often remarked upon this as what we call the Ivan effect. I hope this is not too esoteric. In the movie Casablanca, you have a scene in which Ivan, one of the women in the cast, comes into Rick's with a German soldier as her date, and gets into a fight because she's going out with a German, but nevertheless, or rather the German gets into a fight with a Frenchman, but she sticks with the German. And then later on in the same scene, the Marseillaise strikes up, and Victor Laszlo starts singing the Marseillaise, and you get one shot of Yvonne. She's also standing up there singing the Marseillaise. You might not be able to see it, but that core of nationalism remains there. Mm-hmm. Tibetans see themselves as Tibetan. They don't see themselves as Chinese.
And is there a significant difference between what Tibetans living in Tibet would want and what Tibetans living outside Tibet would want?
You mean vis-a-vis the Chinese government?
Yes.
I think that it's interesting. On a very basic level, I would say no. When you hear the cries resounding in Tibet, and you hear in the news reports they're saying, "Purang Zin Sangmayin, independence for Tibet," by and large, and they take out the Tibetan flag and all of that, by and large, they're asking for independence from China. The people who are advocating autonomy, and in fact, it had gotten to the point where the Dalai Lama's prime minister, two months ago, the Dalai Lama's prime minister said the only thing that we really want is just the basic rights that are guaranteed under China's autonomy law. Now, I don't hear that coming from anybody in Tibet, but I think the greater, you know, the broader mass of Tibetans in exile would not share that. But this is a question of the Dalai Lama's leadership, because if the Dalai Lama did not advocate this, you wouldn't have people like his prime minister saying such things.
Still there, Professor Sperling?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. I really appreciate, by the way, I know you're not feeling 100%, and I really appreciate your
well, I appreciate your indulging me.
I hope that it's not too, this is not too, being too painful an experience.
No.
Okay, good. Back right at the beginning, I just said, well, you know, sort of recap us on what happened, particularly in March, and you talked about the fact that this started March 10th, which is the date of an important uprising that happened in 1959, for Tibetan exiles, this is like a national day of observation, an important date, March 10th.
Yeah, this is their national day.
Yeah. Maybe you could just give us the thumbnail sketch about what happened on March 10th in 1959.
I'll see if I can do it in the thumbnail. Tibet was basically annexed to the People's Republic of China as a result of an agreement signed in 1951. That agreement followed upon a military invasion across the borders of what was then the territory under the jurisdiction of the Dalai Lama. Now, March 17th, 1951, with no other options and with a delegation trying to negotiate in Beijing, the Tibetans basically felt forced to sign the what they call the 17-point agreement for the peaceful liberation of Tibet. That's what the Chinese call it. And this began a period in which Tibet, that is the area under the Dalai Lama's jurisdiction, not the broader Tibetan plateau, but the area under the Dalai Lama's jurisdiction, was brought under the rule of the People's Republic of China. Now, there was a good deal of autonomy in that the Chinese government did not interfere with the monasteries. They didn't carry out the measures, the land reform measures and the attacks on monasteries inside this area that they were doing in the east, in the areas that were not under the Dalai Lama's jurisdiction. But the tensions inherent in that built up, and the revolt eventually originally began in the east, outside the areas of the Dalai Lama's jurisdiction. But because of the ties of the people and the growing mutual hostility, or the growing common hostility that they had to China's domination, a revolt broke out and spread into the area under the Dalai Lama's jurisdiction, which Tibetans rallied to. Tibetans in central Tibet, where the Dalai Lama's government ruled, they rallied to this rebellion as well. And finally, on March 10th, it broke out in Lhasa when the Chinese invited the Dalai Lama to a presentation, a show, and told him to come to the Chinese military encampment, but without his bodyguards. And many Tibetans were convinced that the Dalai Lama was going to be kidnapped. They surrounded his summer palace, didn't let him go, and essentially just touched off the fighting in Lhasa. And so March 10th is considered the national day in commemoration of that. Now, it ultimately resulted in the Dalai Lama's flight and the migration of over 100,000 Tibetans into exile. We don't really know how many fled. There were Tibetans who died en route. There were Tibetans who died after reaching India because they were simply not used to the climate in the plateau, and they were put into transit camps in the worst season, you know, the pre-monsoon season, and many of them died there. So we don't really know how many fled, but this was the beginning of the larger Tibetan exile community and the establishment of the Dalai Lama's government in exile in India.
So this was, now going back to what happened in March, this was on March 10th, we talked about the fact that there was a demonstration by Buddhist monks. They staged a protest. They marched from their monastery on the outskirts of the capital, Lhasa.
Yeah.
And over this took place over several days. This they were rounded up and arrested by the Chinese government. The people there in Tibet were not real happy about the monks were treated. And obviously, they have grievances of their own. And so this blows up into something bigger. But I guess that overall, one of the questions I have is about the timing of this and whether at why it is that this seemed to be happening at this time. And does that have something to do, I suppose, maybe we get back to the Olympics, does that have something to do with the fact that the Chinese at the moment are waging a kind of public relations battle, trying to enhance their image around the world, and perhaps some Tibetans thought, well, this would actually be a good time to give the rest of the world a different sort of message.
Frankly, I think that played into it. I don't know if the thinking was as precise, but I think there was a perception that China, and this is well known within China, that China was trying to present, you know, a very happy face to the outside world with the coming Olympics, and that therefore they would probably be somewhat, how should I say, they would try to be less heavy-handed than usual in dealing with protests. So I think this had something to do with it.
Hmm. You mentioned the fact that, as perhaps people know, that the Dalai Lama left in 1959, left Tibet, and went into India and has been living in India since. That's the seat of his government in exile in Dharamsala. Is the presence of the Dalai Lama a problem for India in its relationship with China?
That's a very interesting question because China has a long history of accusing India of somehow having a hand in the Dalai Lama's activities, in the Dalai Lama fomenting anti-China sentiment. They make all these accusations. And this goes back quite some time. They've often complained about the political activity that Tibetan exiles carry out in India. Now, India is a democracy, and they're allowed to carry out protests. They have freedom of expression. And the Indian government has made it clear to China that the Dalai Lama, and these are their own words, is an honored guest. But it is an issue, and China periodically brings it up, about the Dalai Lama and his presence in India. But India has more or less held fast, but at the same time, India has also gone out of its way not to express great support for Tibetan independence. There was a time, of course, in the 1960s, you know, China and India fought a war, and many Indian politicians actually supported Tibet. And indeed, when China first moved into Tibet, a lot of Tibetans had hoped that India, with which they had relations, would support their case in the United Nations, which, of course, didn't happen. The Indians followed the British, and prior to Indian independence, it had been the British who had had relations with the Tibetans. And they both, when the Tibet case came up in 1950, both countries instructed their delegations to say that the situation was too unclear for any action. And as a result, the United Nations did nothing at the initial time of invasion.
Do you think, and I guess the answer is that some people think the answer to this question is yes, but do you think that at the point where when the Dalai Lama is gone, that the government of India would, in a manner of speaking, invite those Tibetans there at Dharamsala to leave?
That I doubt. I doubt that very strongly. India is a democracy, and there's a lot of sympathy for the Tibetans, whatever the government policy is. But it will have to deal with a group that is, you know, resident in India. Many of them are born in India. Hmm. In fact, a large number of them now are born in India. And it will have to deal with a group that has lost the unifying political leadership that it had. Of course, when the Dalai Lama passes away, there are many people in China who think that the Indian exiles, the exiles, the Tibetan exiles in India, will never be able to duplicate this sort of you know, coherent core, the unified leadership that the exiles have had without this Dalai Lama. Many of them feel that there will be factionalism, and there is factionalism in the Tibetan community in India. There might even be competing claims for different children to be the Dalai Lama, and they're looking at that as dissipating the threat.
Yeah. Our guest, let me just introduce again our guest. We have about 15, actually more like about 10 minutes, a little more than 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. We're talking with Elliot Sperling. He is Associate Professor of Central Eurasian Studies at Indiana University, Bloomington, Indiana. His particular area of interest is Tibetan history, relations between Tibet and China, India as well. And he's talking with us by telephone from there. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have another caller here, someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, this, I wish I'd turned the radio on earlier because I must tell you that I'm in my 80s, and my husband was dean of engineering here at the University of Illinois.
Ma'am, it would really help us if you'd turn your radio down. We're getting some feedback there on the phone.
I just have to walk around the chair.
Hello?
Yeah, I think she's going to turn her radio down.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm sure she'll be back with us in a moment. Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, well, I'm going to fast forward. We were in India. We were in Delhi when the Dalai Lama arrived. Now, that's probably about 30 years ago. And my husband was over there, and we were in India because I also went with him. But he was helping the university there. And so when it was, I don't know how we knew about it, but we were right in Delhi when the Dalai Lama arrived with about 13 or maybe 15 or 20 of his entourage. They had walked from Tibet into India, and we were in Delhi. That's where, and they had their prayer rugs and so forth, and it was simply, of course, not everybody and all the citizens in India knew, but we just happened to know about it, and being foreigners, Americans, we were right there when he and his entourage arrived, and of course, they've never been able to go back. He was just young then; he was only about 19. He was the Dalai Lama from Tibet, and it was most exciting for us because here my husband was professor and dean of engineering here at the University of Illinois, now deceased, but I certainly wish he... now, who you interviewing here on WILL. I just turned in.
Well, ma'am, I guess I could introduce the guest. We're talking this morning with Elliot Sperling. He's an associate professor of Central Eurasian Studies at Indiana University at Bloomington, and he's a Tibet specialist. What was the reaction at the time of people in India to the Dalai Lama's arrival, and did they think that he now all these been a lot more than 30 years that all these many years later he would still be there and his situation would be so sort of unresolved?
Well, when they first came out, came out of Tibet, and I should say this was almost 50 years ago. It was 1959. When they first came out of Tibet, a lot of the Tibetans who came out with the Dalai Lama said they thought that they would be there maybe for a year. They thought that things would be resolved. And, of course, many of them looked towards India. They thought that India would help them and that somehow things would be resolved. But, of course, that turned out not to be the case. And, you know, the longer they stayed, the more it became evident that there was going to be no easy solution to this. Then you get to 1962 and you have a war between India and China. Now, the tension for that had been building up for some time, and there were factions in the Indian government that were very wary of China and very distrustful of China, and then there were other factions in the Indian government, this is Nehru's government, who thought that India and China not only could get along but must get along to present an example for the newly decolonized world, the newly independent nations. In other words, they were thinking that this will show people that it was colonialism that divided the peoples, but that the peoples of Asia and Africa, left to their own devices, of course, lived in perfect harmony with each other, which, of course, is not the case and has turned out not to be the case at all. The border between India and China is still unresolved. There has been no agreement between the two of them to settle the border issue. So, this is a part of a larger issue, a larger problem between India and China.
Yeah. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We're getting really short on time. I want to go on and see if we can get somebody else here. This is also Urbana. It's line number two. Hello.
Hello. Actually, I'm calling from Champaign.
Oh, well, go ahead, though.
Yeah, it's my
ahead.
Fault.
Yeah, sure.
Elliot Patterson is a mystery writer who sets his mysteries in Tibet. And I know it's unfair to the people who haven't read him or heard of him, but I was wondering what you think of his portrayal of the Tibet situation, whether you think it's an over-romanticization, and anything else you can say about that.
I'm afraid I really haven't read him.
Okay. All right, then.
I don't know what to say.
All right, I'm sorry.
Well, let me then ask you another question, though. Supposing that someone was indeed interested, not necessarily reading fiction, but reading something that would try to give them some feeling for Tibet, Tibetan culture, and for this kind of tense relationship that we've been talking about, was there anything in particular that you would recommend?
There's a collection of essays by a very wonderful Tibetan writer named Jamyang Norbu. He's also written a novel. He's written a Sherlock Holmes novel in which Sherlock Holmes is in Tibet, which actually has a basis in the Sherlock Holmes literature because there was a point at which Conan Doyle killed off Sherlock Holmes. He was tired of writing Sherlock Holmes stories, and the public wanted him back. So when he brought him back, he had to make up some sort of story about his absence. And so one of the things he has Sherlock Holmes saying is, well, I spent some time with the Grand Lama in Tibet. So Jamyang Norbu has written this novel, Sherlock Holmes, The Lost Years, which I believe is available. He's also written a book of essays, Shadow Tibet, which I would recommend. He's a very good polemicist and a very good writer in general. And I would say to somebody who's not an academic and who wanted to get a handle on things, that's not a bad place to start.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know the spelling in the last name would be Norbu, but
yeah.
What would be spelling on his first name?
Jamyang.
Okay, good. Well, if people are interested, they can look for that. Let's go again to another caller. This is line three in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Hey. I wanted to ask a question I hope you haven't already answered, and that's China's strategic interest in Tibet. I can understand pretty clearly the strategic interest in Taiwan, but I wonder if you couldn't speak to what is it that has been driving China's global strategic or economic desire to maintain control of Tibet. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, you know, the Chinese desire to hold on to Tibet has been less rooted in the question of the natural resources, wealth under the ground and all of that than a lot of people seem to understand. For a long time, the exploitation of resources in Tibet has been difficult simply because of the inaccessibility of so much of the plateau. You know, it was only 2 years ago that they finally got a train to go to Lhasa, and this is very, very difficult. And, you know, the question is, you know, how much does it cost to maintain, you know, the rail link there? China's real interest actually is, you know, like the Tibetans, it's nationalistic. There was a sense that, and when you speak to most Chinese now, you will get this response that Tibet is Chinese. After the humiliations of the 19th century, and 19th century imperialism, the Opium War, in which Western imperialists and Japanese also dominated parts of China, there was a response in China of tremendous resentment and of a resurgent nationalism and a desire to get back everything that was not that had been taken away from China. Now, of course, the result of this was the idea that everything that had been part of the Qing dynasty, now this is the dynasty that dominated China from 1644 to 1911, and it was during the Qing dynasty that you had the heyday of imperialist activity in China. So there was a sense that whatever had been part of the Qing dynasty was China's heritage. Now, the Qing dynasty was a Manchu dynasty. In other words, it was Manchus from outside the borders of China who had come in the 17th century, conquered China, and established their dynasty there. The Qing dynasty effectively was an empire. And this is what a lot of people in China don't realize, or don't want to realize, or don't want to take seriously. In other words, Tibet's inclusion within the Qing dominions was like an imperial domain. It was not an integral part of China. And the Qing rulers, the Manchu rulers, never made Tibet a part of China. But this sense of wounded pride, this sense of grievance at imperialist depredations in China was such that now everything that had belonged to the Qing must by rights belong to China. Now, the interesting thing is that under the Qing, Tibet and Mongolia had very similar statuses. Mongolia today is independent, and it's independent because the Mongols had Stalin as a patron in the 20th century. Whereas the Tibetans had the British in India. And as a Tibetan friend of mine once said, that's the problem. You know, the Russians play chess, the British play cricket. And so Stalin was able to maneuver to keep Mongolia out of China. And the interesting thing is, of course, Mongolia then fell under Stalinist domination, and that was quite brutal in its own right. But today, Mongolia is independent, whereas Tibet is not. I mean, it's interesting also because there's this transformation of empire into the notion of, well, this is all part of China, that it's all Chinese. It's a very interesting transformation, but I don't think I have enough time to go into a long lecture on that.
We do have a minute or two left. Just let me ask you one last question. The Dalai Lama has forever been dedicated to nonviolence. However, one wonders whether within the Tibetan exile community, and perhaps not just the exile community, but within the Tibetan community, particularly among younger Tibetans, whether there would be any inclination that this the way to wage the struggle would be to turn it into an armed struggle?
Well, that's absolutely out of the question for Tibetans in India, for Tibetans in exile. The fact is the Indian government would never, absolutely never allow Indian territory be used as a base for any sort of violent terrorist operation, period, against certainly against China. So that's out of the question there. And I think it's something of a red herring when that's brought up. The other thing, though, about the Dalai Lama being against nonviolence, well, when he first came out in 1959, he was not telling the Kampas, the other Tibetans who had been fighting and who escorted him out of Tibet, he was not telling them to lay down their weapons.
Yeah.
And he wrote in his first autobiography that he had no alternative to give them. In his second autobiography, he is very much a follower of Gandhian Ahimsa, So there's been a transformation there. And I should add that the Dalai Lamas traditionally have not been absolutists about nonviolence. Tibet had an army, Tibet had soldiers, and the Dalai Lamas at times ordered soldiers out to fight.
Do you think that, here I'm asking a question, I can't really give you much time, but do you think that the Tibetans are, because of the fact that the Dalai Lama is highly regarded, particularly here in the United States, and has always been well received, the Tibetans think that are looking to the United States for a kind of support in this that the United States actually can't or won't give?
I think they're fairly realistic. I don't think any Tibetan thinks that the United States is going to send its forces into Tibet the way they did in Iraq. I think they're fairly grateful for the support that they do receive in the United States from a number of prominent people. Most recently, Nancy Pelosi has been very active with regard to Tibet. Previously, the late Tom Lantos in the Congress was also very active. But I think Tibetans are fairly realistic about that.
Well, there we will leave it with our thanks to our guest, Elliot Sperling, Associate Professor of Central Eurasian Studies at Indiana University, Bloomington. Professor Sperling, thanks very much for being with us. I hope you feel better soon.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure being with you.